Oweekitiibwa Bahati awulira eddoboozi lya Katonda era wawulira bino yawumya omutwe mu kubaga etteeka eryo eribiwakanya.
Etteeka
bano bagerere bagambe kino tewali okubaganya birowoozo.
Opportunity Ugandans have now to tell the whole world that our business is to do what God wants. This is an opportunity for Ugandans to tell the whole world that our religion is not to man, wherever that man may be. Our religion is not to nations, however powerful those nations may be. Our religion is to God.
That was in Saba Buturo. Buturo was a cabinet-level official in the Ugandan government in 2010, speaking at an event known as The Call in Kampala, Uganda. The Call was organized by Lou Engel, an American charismatic who is part of the New Apostolic Reformation. Think of Engel in the camp of the non-denominational charismatic Christian nationalists I talked about in the last episode. Buturo was invited to speak at Engel's rally to support a bill in parliament called the Anti-Homosexuality Bill. Engel was in Uganda to support the effort.
We are restraining, trying to restrain an agenda that's going to hurt the nation and hurt families. I believe Uganda has suddenly become ground zero. God brought you to make a statement, to stand for righteousness.
Buturo was asking for prayer for parliamentarian David Bahati. He said Honorable Bahati had heard the voice of God. He said passing the bill, which would apply the death penalty for private adult conduct, would be listening to God and not men. In 2009, Bahati was a member of the Ugandan parliament and was the co-author of what came to be known as the Kill the Gays Bill. It was called that because it originally proposed the death penalty for certain homosexual behaviors and life in prison for any kind of same-sex intimacy. Buturo and Bahati believed the state should follow the teaching of the church, or at least one version of church teaching, in civil law. Bahati, who was trained as an accountant in the West, is currently the Minister of State for Trade, Industry, and Cooperatives in the Cabinet of Uganda. In 2009, when this bill was introduced, I learned that evangelical Christians in Uganda were behind the bill, and I searched for what had influenced them. Everyone I talked to believed that the proper basis for law in a Christian nation was the Bible. Ugandan legislators saw themselves as lawmakers in a Christian nation, and so they believed the Bible, primarily Old Testament rules, should guide them. What they were saying then sounds a lot like Christian nationalists today. The Seven Mountains message looms large in the New Apostolic Reformation now, and it did then. Donald Trump's most ardent Christian nationalist support comes from this tradition. At that time, Ugandan apostle Julius Oyet prophesied that 2009 would be the year that Ugandans would take dominion. He wrote, quote, "God will judge evil in 2009 as mob justice will kill and destroy witches, thieves, and evil people. There will be lots of manifestation of Satanists and exposition of homosexuality and other evils in the church. Human sacrifice and all sorts of evil will manifest in the nations. God's people will rise in full authority and dominion. The righteous will march against evil and triumph over them all." End quote. If you listen, you can hear a lot of rhetoric like that in 2024. Over the months the bill was being debated both in Uganda and around the world, I became a vocal opponent of the bill and helped mobilize evangelical opposition. At the time, I found it relatively easy to recruit thousands of evangelicals to oppose the Ugandan anti-gay bill. Most evangelicals took the position that they personally believed homosexuality to be immoral, but did not believe the state should penalize private conduct. In other words, their position was not consistent with Christian nationalism. In fact, the Ugandan bill, which was a worldwide story for months, was clarifying. Almost no Christians came out in support of the bill. Even people who opposed gay marriage said the state should not use violence against citizens to regulate private behavior. At that time, some people were using the term Christian nationalism. I first used it on my blog in 2011. I interviewed Reconstructionists, Seven Mountains Dominionists, right-wing Christian nationalists, and members of the Secretive Fellowship Foundation. I was even invited to attend the National Prayer Breakfast, sitting in a hotel room with a group of African delegates to the meeting while we watched Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton condemn the Ugandan bill.
And I recently called President Museveni, whom I have known through the prayer breakfast, and expressed the strongest concerns about a law being considered in the Parliament of Uganda.
We may disagree about gay marriage, but surely we can agree that it is unconscionable to target gays and lesbians for who they are, whether it's here in the United States or, as Hillary mentioned, more extremely and odious laws that are being proposed most recently in Uganda.
I wasn't a popular guy in the room. Eventually, in 2014, the anti-homosexuality bill was passed with some modifications, but then soon after declared unconstitutional and nullified. However, it was reintroduced more recently in 2023. This time around, it easily passed the Ugandan parliament with much less worldwide opposition. Just last week, the Ugandan Supreme Court declined to nullify it and allowed most of it to stand as passed by the parliament. Evangelicals in the United States were much less vocal about the bill, and some Christian nationalists were openly supportive. Something has changed in just over a decade. For instance, when the first bill was introduced in 2009, Fellowship Foundation spiritual leader Doug Coe personally told me that he opposed the bill and that it was against the teachings of Jesus. He asked me to make sure to publish his views, which I did in a Christianity Today article. Journalist Jonathan Larson said the tone within the fellowship has shifted in recent years.
Just last month, the new leadership of the Fellowship Foundation was asked flat out by Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, head of the Congressional Equality Caucus, the LGBTQ caucus, do you condemn the Uganda law? And they would not. The president of the board would not do that, would not say in flat out plain language, yeah, we condemn that. They basically said, you know, we don't agree with lots of things that people say and do. And that was as far as they were willing to go. The other story I reported just at the end of last year was that Tim Walberg of Michigan, definitely a Fellowship Foundation insider, he went on a trip to Uganda for their national prayer breakfast last year, after the death penalty became law in Uganda. The trip was paid for by the Fellowship Foundation, which is the reason that Pocan was asking them about their position on it. And at their national prayer breakfast, he told the president of Uganda and he told the people of Uganda to stand firm in the face of international opposition to this law. And what people need to understand is that the subtext for this was that this international opposition to Uganda's death penalty could and has already started leading to economic consequences for Uganda. And to whatever extent Uganda starts feeling economic pain because of this law, that's a political threat to Museveni, the president. And so the purpose of Walberg going there was to do a couple things. One was to bolster Museveni by telling the people, stand behind this guy because he's fighting for what God wants. So don't penalize him politically for the economic consequences. But he was also signaling, hey, hang in there because the Christian right in the U.S. is on your side here. So the pain will be temporary. So just hang in there. These are all, as you say, these are all things that are obviously not what you would do if you have a real problem with the death penalty for gay people.
When church and state are not separate, when religion and politics are intertwined, people can get hurt. Looking back, my interest in David Barton's approach to church and state was triggered by the dangerous Christian nationalism I saw on display in Uganda. When I looked for people in the U.S., who called for degrading that wall of separation all roads led back to Barton, the Where's Waldo of the Christian nationalist movement. At that point, I started to fact-check the claims that Barton said led him to question church-state separation and promote Christian nationalism. The rest, as they say, is history. I'm Warren Throckmorton, and along with Michael Coulter wrote Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. You're listening to the podcast series Telling Jefferson Lies, a story about how history can be hijacked for ideological and political purposes. In previous episodes, we told the story of how David Barton's best-selling book about Thomas Jefferson was removed from publication in 2012 due to historical errors. Today, I examine some of the negative consequences of Christian nationalism. During the last week of April 2024, I will conclude the series by celebrating the virtues of religious pluralism and the separation of church and state. This is Episode 11, The Consequences of Christian Nationalism. Bars are open down on Rivington Street. No call, no show, no work today. Wondering if this girl can get something to eat. Well, the job just took the breath from him. And the paycheck never sat too tall. Wants to give that girl the best he's got. Cause the world awaits us all. Most of this series has been dedicated to the proposition that Christian nationalism is based on bad history. Numerous experts have affirmed that fact in earlier episodes, and I hope the evidence has convinced you. The remaining episodes will examine other reasons why I don't like Christian nationalism. In essence, I think every form of Christian nationalism is bad history, bad politics, and bad religion. It might be causing inflation, too. I'll get back to you on that. Uganda's anti-gay bill wasn't the only example of state-sanctioned violence that influenced me to think about church and state in the United States. In Pakistan in 2010, another story captured the attention of the world in much the same way as the Ugandan bill. Asiya Noreen Bibi was imprisoned in Pakistan on the accusation of violating the nation's blasphemy laws. She was accused by neighbors of speaking negatively about the Prophet Muhammad. In all, she spent 8 years in prison before she was pardoned and received political asylum in Canada, where she lives now with her family. Bibi, a Christian woman, denied speaking ill of Muhammad, but the allegation and her status as a religious minority demonstrated the peril of uniting church and state.
What I'm planning to do today, in fact, is to meet with opposition politicians, because what the aim is obviously repeal the blasphemy laws or to make any amendments to it. It'll need to be passed in Parliament. I mean, that's the bigger picture, to try and, you know, make sure that such a situation doesn't arise again to any other Christian minority. So Parliament needs to make amendments to the law or get rid of the law entirely. So what I'm doing is I'm engaging with the opposition parties as well to try and find out how they might be voting on the issue when it does come to Parliament.
That was Raza Ansum, a legislator from the United Kingdom, who spoke to me by phone during a visit to Pakistan in 2010. In the clip, he told me he was attempting to broker a deal to repeal blasphemy laws in Pakistan. He had gone there also seeking the release of Asiya Bibi. He hoped to meet with her on Christmas Day, but was not able to due to the growing unrest surrounding her situation. Ansum's mission was noble, but eventually unsuccessful. There was significant bloodshed surrounding the detention of Asiya Bibi. The governor of the province where she was being held was perceived as being too lenient with her. and eventually he was murdered by one of his own security guards who turned on him. Asiabibi was constantly the target of death threats and was treated in prison while awaiting trial and sentencing. At times, it seemed she would die in prison before she could be released or receive her sentence. The entire harrowing saga was a frightening lesson in what blasphemy laws could look like in a future Christian nationalist state. I covered Stephen Wolfe's book in Episode 8, Wolf in Wolf's Clothing. He said that imprisonment is in principle possible for violators of blasphemy laws in a Christian nationalist regime. Wolfe also said that in principle, the death penalty was on the table for people he labeled arch-heretics, or people who persisted in promoting serious heresy. While he didn't specify what that was, it really doesn't matter. In 2024, saying that one recommends killing someone for religious differences should disqualify a person from being taken seriously. However, in today's evangelical world, it gets you featured in a World Magazine article on Christian nationalism. Really, just last week. And the authors just wrote about it all matter-of-fact-like. And Wolfe isn't alone.
There is an occult element at the high levels of society, and specifically among the Jews. So many of the people that are perpetrating the lies and the destruction on the country, they are evildoers. They are people that worship false gods. They are people that practice magic or rituals or whatever. And more than anything, those people need to be, when we take power, they need to be given the death penalty. Straight up. And I'm far more concerned about that than I am about even non-white people or mass migration. These people that are communing with demons and engaging in this sort of witchcraft and stuff, and these people that are suppressing the name Christ and suppressing Christianity, they must be absolutely annihilated when we take power. This is God's country. This is Jesus' country. This is not the domain of atheists or devil worshipers or perfidious Jews. This is Christ's country.
That was Nick Fuentes, who had dinner with evangelical darling Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in 2023. You remember Donald Trump? He used to be president and wants to be again. When I started the Getting Jefferson Right project, I was concerned about the misuse of history to erode the wall of separation between church and state. I looked at the situations in Uganda and Pakistan and saw what was happening there when the wall of separation was compromised. I became increasingly worried about what an erosion of the wall would look like here. My attention turned to David Barton because, in the U.S., he seemed to be the source of the idea that the wall of separation between church and state was a myth. He also teaches that the Bible is and should be the source of civil law. Accompanying his philosophical stance were numerous faulty claims about the founding era. In 2011, I began to fact-check those claims. I was certainly not the first to do so, but I wanted to check the claims for myself. As this series has documented, Barton may be the Where's Waldo of the Christian nationalist movement, but he isn't the only one. Others have manifested the desire to use government power to coerce Christianity in different ways. That's what I want to focus on in the next two episodes. In this episode, I focus on state-sponsored violence, violence to take control of the government, degrading of democratic institutions, and minimization of minority rights. In the next episode, I examine how Christian nationalism is bad for Christianity.
Christo-authoritarians, just like Christian nationalists, are overtly in favor of leveraging, you know, the coercive apparatus of the state to defend their interests. And part of that mission and part of how they narrate to themselves why it's legitimate is that they think the nation was founded explicitly as, you know, a Christian nation. And so what they're doing is really claiming their, if you like, spiritual or ideological inheritance, as though Thomas Jefferson would fit right in a, evangelical Christian church, like, you know, in the 21st century. They're like, no, that's, you know, we're the people that this country is for. And so even if we have to adopt some anti-democratic means to reclaim power, you know, that's what we have to do. Even if we have to take it by violence, it's ours. We're taking back what's ours.
That was Mount St. Mary's University philosophy lecturer Scott Coley describing the entitlement that energizes Christian nationalists who threaten civil war to get their way. Speaking of civil war, Jeff Charlotte's recent book, Undertow: Scenes from a Slow Civil War, documents the division in the land. The book's description paints a picture of that desperation. Quote, "Across the country, men of God glorify materialism, a gluttony of the soul, while citing scripture and preparing for civil war. A firestorm they long for as an absolution and exaltation. Lies, greed, and glorification of war boom through microphones at hipster megachurches that once upon a time might have preached peace and understanding. Political rallies are as aflame with need and giddy expectation as religious revivals. At a conference for incels, lonely single men come together to rage against women. On the far right, everything is heightened. Love into adulation, fear into vengeance, anger into white-hot rage. Here in the undertow, our 45th president, a vessel of conspiratorial fears and fantasies, continues to rise to sainthood. And the insurrectionist, Ashley Babbitt, killed on January 6th at the Capitol, is beatified as a martyr of white womanhood." End quote. Observers of Christian nationalist leaders and groups are growing increasingly worried about the potential for violent rhetoric from Christian nationalist leaders to again cross over into January 6th insurrection-like action. Religion scholar Matthew Taylor has documented the connection between the January 6th insurrection and Christian nationalist involvement, especially among the apostolic charismatic leaders.
I mean, they truly see American politics as a zone of cosmic combat. And it's, there's a desperation to it and also an optimism to it that I think that we could very well see them push things over the edge again into real violence with all of these charismatic manifestations around shofars and Jericho marches, and all this stuff. I don't really see a scenario in which we get out of the next year unscathed. I mean, if Trump wins, all bets are off, right? But even if Biden wins and is declared winner, I don't see a way that this election goes uncontested. And for these spiritual warfare folks, a contested election, which they threw their shoulders into in 2000 and really threw their shoulders into in 2020, is a time for all-out spiritual jihad. They want to get their followers in the streets. They want to drive this kind of strategic level spiritual warfare, to use Wagner's terminology, to actually change American politics. And they don't really care that much about democracy. They believe that they are fulfilling the will of God. And I think I'm trying to keep a close eye on them, but they are unfazed. If Trump was willing to push things on January 6th, because he wanted four more years in the White House, what is he willing to do to stay out of jail?
Although the preachers may or may not be doing the shooting, there are groups who talk about violence a lot. Groups like the League of the South, the Stand Back and Stand By Proud Boys, and the Oath Keepers. It might be those fellows that apostolic charismatic Johnny Inlow is thinking about who might answer Trump's call if he decides to call for revolution.
Yeah, well, the way I don't think the timing has changed, if the timing being right would mean that the Democrats would not have been allowed to steal the election, then yes. But I do not believe that for one moment that he has stepped back at all, particularly in the eyes of the Lord, as being the ruling. I say it over and over, and this is the part I've never changed. He is the number one kingdom asset for government on planet Earth, and has been. That has not changed. And just because there's a stealing of election, his influence is is so powerful. I don't think people understand that if he really was panicked about us losing, you know, he's older in life, even though he's maintaining his strength and everything well. If he's nearing 80 and he thinks we've really lost the country, he would be justified in calling for a revolution and sure. saying we have to, for my kids and for my kids' kids' sake, we have to be willing. And if he made that call, they would find out he is the man of power in this country. Because not only is it in the eyes of God, but in the eyes of men, if he gave any hint or evidence that we have lost it, you know, he says we've lost it, but there's always this thing of they're working and something's happening. But if ever he just put on the desperation thing, it's like, it's time to take up arms. We have to be willing to go.
Seven Mountains Mandate marketer Lance Wallnau recently said that demons are talking right through liberals. This is a literal demonization of people who oppose him ideologically.
You see, the left is loaded with demons, and those demons project on everyone else what they secretly are all about. I don't think it's people anymore. I think you're dealing with demons talking through people. You look at those old speeches in Nuremberg, or you look at those Hitler rallies, and what you see is that Satan, by the spirit of Antichrist, it's a mouth that speaks great and swelling words. So you're going to see, just remember this, Christian, that you're going to listen to demons talking through people.
Wallnau wants his followers to dehumanize Democrats and others who do not support Trump and other candidates Wallnau supports. Elsewhere, among the right-wing Christian nationalists, Southern Baptist and former Trump administration official William Wolfe says it is getting close to time to take up arms.
Samuel Davies was an early American Presbyterian minister, and he preached a sermon titled The Curse of Cowardice in 1758. This was during the French and Indian War, and Davies had moved back to Hanover, Virginia, and he was trying to rally the local militia to join in and fight with the British. At that time, they were still all British, against the French and against the Indians. He says, "When in this corrupt, disordered state of things, where the lusts of men are perpetually embroiling the world with wars and fighting and throwing all into confusion, when ambition and avarice would rob us of our property for which we have toiled, on which we subsist, when they would enslave the freeborn mind and compel us meanly to cringe to usurpation and arbitrary power, when this is the case, what is then the will of God? Must peace then be maintained with our perfidious and cruel invaders, maintained at the expense of property, liberty, life, and everything dear and valuable, maintained when it is in our power to vindicate our right and do ourselves justice? Is the work of peace then our only business? No. In such a time, even the God of peace proclaims by his providence to arms. And if we have ever lived in a point in time in American history since then that we could argue that now is the time to arms again, I think we are getting close. Now, Davies sets that out and says that it is right, even though as Christians we seek peace, that when the enemy is pressed upon us, if we fail to heed the call to arms, then we are acting as cowards.
Sadly, I could play dozens more clips like this. Let me hasten to add that not all Christian nationalists believe in violence, but the violent rhetoric is increasing among people near the highest levels of the Republican Party. This is what increases the need to take it seriously. Not all attacks on the separation of church and state involve threats of violence. Another negative consequence of Christian nationalism is the erosion of democratic principles. Proposals to ban women from voting, banning books in school libraries, gerrymandering, voter suppression, and limiting personal rights in the name of imposing one view of Christianity are just several ways that democratic principles can be hindered. In earlier episodes, I described Project Blitz, which promotes placing copies of Ten Commandments in public school classrooms, In God We Trust signs in schools, and legislation which allows schools to hire chaplains instead of school counselors. These types of laws, when enacted, skirt the First Amendment's prohibition on establishment of religion, and until challenged, may create de facto establishments. The current Supreme Court seems receptive to religious expression in public spaces, as illustrated by the Kennedy v. Bremerton School District case, which granted relief to a football coach who was fired for praying at midfield after football games. There is a lot at stake for Christian nationalists in the upcoming election. Charlie Kirk says if Donald Trump doesn't win, his followers must be prepared to fight, although I don't know what he means by that. The Heritage Foundation is promoting something called the Mandate for Leadership, which is the product of what they say is over 400 scholars and organizations. In essence, it is a blueprint for what Christian nationalists want to see in a Trump administration. One of the authors of the document is Russell Vought. Vought's view of religious liberty is decidedly different than mine, and I would argue is not in keeping with the Jeffersonian vision either.
Being a nation that's for God, that's a consensus that we want to renew in this country, that we have religious liberty, but it cannot come from this notion that a country isn't understanding the reality that it has to obey God, and there is only one true God, and that is Jesus Christ, our Lord. So that is a big part of what we do, is reestablishing that notion in our public policy, and to be able to argue on the basis of public policy those certain truths. And that truth just comes from revelation and about being a nation that's for God. That's a consensus that we want to.
It seems to me that Voight gives religious liberty and then takes it away.
Here's the problem with Christian nationalism. It can too easily lead to authoritarianism and control of others and a lack of respect for their rights. I mean, if you really believe that your political opinions come down on high from God and they can't be challenged, then you don't really have any obligation to respect your neighbor who thinks differently. Or even that the most extreme cases, allow them their right to worship. I mean, why would you want to let these false religions exist alongside the one that you know is good and true, that has been ordained, and that God wants us to be? So I think Christian nationalism takes the American experiment of diversity and religious freedom for everybody and obliterates that. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor died recently, and while her record on church state tended to be mixed, she did say something in one of her last opinions where she warned us that if you're going to be renegotiating the boundaries between church and state, you might want to, and I'm paraphrasing here, you might want to ask yourself why you want to trade a system that's worked so well for something else. And there are a lot of people in the world right now who are living under the iron heel of religious oppression, whether it's a Christian fundamentalist state, an Islamic theocracy, whatever it might be, or even Hindu nationalism, who would really like to have that distance between religion and government, who look to us as a model. I would just love to see us uplift that and celebrate it. Instead, there are people like Barton teaching people that it's something to be feared and discarded and not celebrated. And that's a real shame.
That was Rob Boston, Communications Director for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. To illustrate Boston's concern, listen to Pennsylvania State Representative Stephanie Borowitz describe her legislative strategy of non-engagement.
They need to come to a knowledge of their Savior, Jesus Christ. And so I've shared the gospel. I would never team up with someone and do a bill on the other side, because why would I ever team up with someone that stands for those things? And so that's clear to me. Like, you don't do that. And I've seen a lot of even conservatives try to, oh, well, we'll meet in the middle with, no, I don't play that game. Like, we don't do those things. The things that those on the left stand for is very, it's vile, perverse. It's the opposite of God's word.
Representative Borowitz may not want to work with her colleagues, but the way I see it, that is the job her constituents elected her to do. The author of Power Worshippers, Catherine Stewart, agrees with Boston's concerns about the erosion of democratic principles.
Christian nationalist leaders have shown us how far they're willing to go They're willing to spread lies. They're willing to support the overturning of our democracy. They're willing to rewrite the Constitution. They really want a less democratic republic. They really want, you know, they really want a society in which people with a sort of correct religious and political views have the right to dominate everybody else. And they want to create a kind of theocratic political oligarchy. You know, they're willing to diminish voting rights and steal votes from people whose political views they disagree with. They delight in it. In fact, one of the gatherings I attended, I heard Ralph Reed, it was probably a Road to Majority conference that he organizes every year. He was talking about gerrymandering, right? Often it's race-based, not always. It's, you know, affects Democratic districts. And he called it the Republican reapportionment advantage. He said this very cheerfully. He said, thanks to the Republican reapportionment advantage, if Democrats are up 1 to 4 points, we win. If they're up 4 to 7 points, it's a jump ball. And if they're up 8 points or more, that's when they win. I mean, think about it. This is so anti-democratic. It's really flies in the face of voting is the foundation of one of the foundations of our democracy. They really want to destroy institutions that have served us over time. They want to remake public schools while also diverting money from public schools to funding private religious schools and destroying separation of church and state. They want to dominate the judiciary. So they're willing to do a lot.
To summarize, Christian nationalism is no friend to the American system of government. Despite all of the bluster about the Constitution, Christian nationalists, such as David Barton, have to reinterpret it to make it fit their desired outcome. Christian nationalism as a movement seeks to degrade the natural rights non-Christians, non-Republican citizens enjoy. This leads me to another casualty of Christian nationalism, the increasing alienation of minorities and insensitivity to minority rights.
We got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done. They poison mental institutions and...
Earlier in the series, I spent 2 episodes on David Barton's historical whitewashing of Thomas Jefferson's record on race, slavery, and civil rights. Christian nationalists have attempted to stifle the teaching of African American history, obscure a truthful history of slavery and Jim Crow, attack critical race theory, and ban books on race in school libraries. In these various ways, Christian nationalists have thrown up roadblocks to equality and justice. Here again is author and historian Jamar Tisby.
Follow the power. Whenever you're looking at history or theology, ask yourself, who does this empower? Who does this disempower? And I'm talking about the approach here. So in a person like David Barton, his approach to history, who does it empower? Who does it disempower? Whose stories does it tell? And how accurately? And to what effect? And so what's often the case, far-right scholarship, if you want to call it that, is it's enshrining a status quo or trying to revive what they believed was a status quo in a bygone era. This is the whole spirit of make America great again. So there was a time in U.S. history when the United States was great, but follow the power. Great for whom is the question we must ask, which is always the immediate retort to make America great again. For whom was it great? Because it wasn't great for women, for black people, for LGBTQ people, for poor people. It's still not great. So then again, who does this help? Who does this empower? Namely, white men.
Louisville pastor and social worker Joel Bowman agrees that there isn't much good for him in the Make America Great Again rhetoric.
Whenever I hear the slogan, Make America Great Again, then obviously the question arises in my mind, when was America truly great for black people and other persons of color? Trumpism is fundamentally about nostalgia and kind of getting back to quote unquote the good old days. And if they're referring to, let's say, the 1950s, or the 1960s, then, you know, naturally those weren't the good old days because, you know, Jim Crow was still in force. And so I believe when African Americans hear that slogan, it really is heard as an obvious dog whistle that is being blown into the ears of white evangelicals and people who are into Christian nationalism. So, yeah, from the very beginning, when Trump began to really brand himself and use that nomenclature, it never sat well with me, because understanding history the way I do, I saw it as a call for the country to go back to when it was whiter and when there was a more structured racial social order and where white folks were clearly dominating and in the majority. And so I've never heard it as a positive slogan. It's always had a racialized tinge to it.
Historian and civil rights activist Troy Jackson sees the attacks on teaching history as a backlash to racial reconciliation efforts after the murder of George Floyd.
I don't think we could have predicted what has happened since the murder of George Floyd with this strategic decision by some on the hard right and the Christian right to basically flip a national reckoning on race with backlash and to go on the assault, to use a term from critical legal theory, like critical race theory, to take a term like woke and weaponize them, to, with critical race theory, redefine it, first redefine it, and then weaponize it and apply it in ways that have led, and in the work I do with Undivided now, we see clergy and congregations less willing to lead well on race today than they were 3 years ago in the fall of 2020. We see an all-out assault that began with a presidential order in the fall of 2020 around the teaching of history and the reaction to the 1619 Project with the 1776 Project, the way that Texas and Florida schools are stripping honest tellings of our history around race, particularly.
Around the nation, Christian nationalists have pursued the revision of history regarding slavery and racism. David Barton significantly de-emphasizes the race-based nature of American slavery by saying that slavery in the United States was not a race problem, but a sin problem. Higher education has also been in the sights of Christian nationalists via attacks on critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Jennifer Hollenberger, associate professor of social work at Grove City College, says those efforts could have a negative effect if put into practice.
I'm taking this understanding that if we can't teach about the realities of the history of oppression in our country as it relates to race and culture, then we're not able to acknowledge structural oppression. So I'm already coming from a place where, no, I believe that structural oppression exists and it creates inequitable policies for people. And when we can't teach about the realities of the history of race and oppression in our country, it results in a lack of awareness about systemic or structural problems. And so if, as we're trying to address those problems, address social problems as social workers, will we be able to solve the quote root problem if we don't even understand what the root is? If we can't understand the struggles and even the achievements that groups of individuals in our country have experienced, we're losing the sense of shared history or collective efforts towards justice.
It is fitting to end this episode by discussing minority rights. As Dartmouth College historian Randall Balmer reminds us, one aspiration of America is protection of minorities, even though we haven't done a great job of that.
One of the glories of the United States, in my judgment, is that our charter documents have always made provisions for minorities. That is to say, we are not a majoritarian culture or society. The majority cannot impose its will on the minority. Now, we've come very close many times to doing that. And it's also true that we have been slow, far, far too slow to ensure the rights of minorities, particularly people of color and women.
In Uganda, the Christian nationalist majority rose up to threaten the lives of the minority LGBTQ population. This has again become a current issue. One could talk about it as a political issue, but it is today just as much a religious story as it is a political one. Back in 2009, Julius Oyette and Martin Semple, in league with government minister Nsaba Buturo and parliamentarian David Bahati in Uganda, saw themselves as taking dominion over the mountains of government, religion, and the family. At that time, Julius Oyette was considered an apostle by Apostle Johnny Inlow, who today considers revolution an acceptable alternative for Donald Trump if those stubborn demons won't give up the mountains on Trump's timetable. In Uganda, LGBTQ minority rights have been and are being sacrificed. In the United States, what minorities are at risk? If we know our history, we know where to look. The Charlie Kirks and Matt Walshes of the Christian nationalist world are worried about white people being replaced. Who are their targets? People of color? Immigrants? LGBTQ people? Jews? Muslims? I could go on. The United States is a diverse nation, and there are several types of Christian nationalists with many grievances and fears. My point is that the threat is real. Ask LGBTQ people in Uganda. Ask Asia Bibi. Ask Muslims and Christians where Hindu nationalism is strong. Ask immigrants at a Trump rally. I have heard no convincing rationale from Christian nationalists about how they intend to keep history from repeating itself. If you ask former Trump administration official General William Wolfe, that's not a big concern because his group is pretty large. In fact, someone did ask him that about Baptists.
But back to the idea of historical injustices, you know, if we had some form of Christian nationalism and under that form persecuting Baptists was bad, by what standard do you judge that by? Well, you judge it by a Christian standard. And so in a new Christian nationalism, we want to work to have a better standard by which Baptists aren't whipped or flogged or sure. drowned, etc. And, you know, I would also like to remind my fellow Baptists that we aren't the shrinking violet in American evangelicalism. We're, you know, millions strong, right? So, you know, I'm pretty confident that if anybody's going to be doing the persecuting, it'll be us.
You check our own ranks.
Yeah.
Lord have mercy. In this series, I have labored to demonstrate that Christian nationalism is bad news and bad history. In this episode, I hope I've convinced you with a brief overview of some of the reasons why I believe Christian nationalism is bad civics and bad politics. In the next episode, I make a case that Christian nationalism is bad religion. Let me set the stage. It should go without saying that it is bad religion if you have to use violence to coerce cultural submission to your religion. It's bad religion if it leads you away from truth via revisionist history, distorted science, and conspiracy theories. Good religion should lead to a desire for peace and truth. Lord willing, that's what the next episode will be about. Today's closing song is Debris by Roman Candle. Telling Jefferson Lies' theme song is The World Awaits Us All, also by Roman Candle. See the show notes for more credits. Just two more episodes to go. Please like the podcast and spread the word on social media. Thanks for listening.
far, far behind were two high schools where my parents used to teach. And though I grew up several hundred miles inland, it seemed to make sense at the time. And there was nobody on the beach but me walking. And I liked that just fine. On the right, there were some chained-up arcades, and I thought for a minute I was in Ocean City. But I kept walking, and I recognized the beach. I was in Kitty Hawk. Now, I don't believe in allegory or one-to-one relationships when you're trying to talk about a dream. So I'm just telling you what I saw. But behind me, walking in a single-file line, as far as I could see, were a bunch of pigs, livestock pigs. I don't know anything about pigs. They could have been Hereford pigs or Vietnamese pigs, some kind of a mutt pig. But they had this overcoarse black hair on top of this skin that looked like an old cheese. It was like a bunch of women going bald, but not as pretty, in Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk, oh Kitty. Now, as I was walking down the beach, I could see behind me these pigs one at a time would file off and walk straight into the waves and not come back. And further up down the beach, these pigs were coming back out of the water. And I could see they were covered in some kind of a garbage. And there were people way up on the beach taking this garbage off of the pigs and building something. It looked kind of like a house. Again, I wasn't paying much attention, but when I got close enough to talk to the people, everything started to seem really familiar. And I asked one of them, "What are you all building?" And she said, "I told you already. It's a hospital."